who's an experienced person. Alright. Okay, so tonight we're going to start a series of classes on mind and its potential. We'll have four classes on this topic. Because according to Buddhism, transforming the mind is key to having true, genuine, deep, lasting happiness and well-being. So we'll explore what is the mind according to Buddhism, what this mind transformation involves, and even more information about the mind and wanting to know. But it's very useful. I find this topic very, very helpful and very, very useful to hear over and over again. Because we are constantly trying to find happiness outside. Right? And everybody tells us, all of the advertisement on how entire culture is telling us that happiness is in money and positions and success and all of those things. But still, somehow, it seems like there's something missing. If you have what the world, what the society tells you should bring you happiness, and you're not happy, you think, what's wrong? What's wrong? I should be happy. What's wrong with me? But there's nothing wrong with you. Those external things actually by nature cannot bring deep lasting happiness. But of course, our society doesn't tell us that. Especially marketing. So why are we here?
In this class, on this planet?
That's a good question.
One more clarification.
So why are we here in this class?
Learn about the mind, essentially. Understand better what this is capable of and not capable of.
Yeah. And why? Why do we need to know that? Are you looking for something?
I'm looking for, personally, for a way not to be at the mercy of my thoughts,
yeah.
My thoughts and my emotions. The same ones over and over and over.
So you see that those thoughts and emotions are not always bringing you happiness. See that it can be quite problematic.
I'm here, what you already said about placing our well-being on things that are already changing all the time. It's just hearing you say that, even though it's the first time hearing it, somehow it goes in. So I'm just hoping to be here and nourish myself, get out of the doing a little bit.
Get out of the doing.
Yeah.
For me, it's so easy to forget. It's like, 99% of my surroundings is like, get the better job, buy the house. And so, for me, it's like, it's so easy to fall back into the old patterns and be like, well, there's ways of getting things, or like, yeah. And so, and just like everyone judging you for not doing that stuff and doing this other stuff instead. And so, you really, like, for me, sometimes I'm like, I panic and I'm like, oh my gosh, am I really doing the right thing? Like, and
right.
Because like most things in my life, my own experience doesn't tell me this, but everything around me, which I guess is also my experience, tells me, other people are telling me it's wrong or something. But then my own experience tells me that it's right, but then I don't, we're also taught not to trust ourselves too, so.
Oh, yeah. It's hard. the whole of society is taking us one way, and then the Dharma is saying to do this, which was right, which was right. Yeah, and we hear, right, we hear this other thing all the time. Team one happiness. Something deeper. Something lasting. Deep sense of well-being. And where can you find that? What? Examine what our culture is telling us. Happiness is in the money, in the house, in the success, in possessions, in status, or maybe power, reputation. So really, I mean, it's useful to not just accept this, right? Not to just accept what society says, and not to just accept what Buddha said either, right? Let's just really check up. So really, really, can any of those things bring lasting happiness? Genuine happiness? We get them, right? We get the new job, and then? We get it after a year.
Right.
Our coworkers
right.
are terrible. How long does that bring satisfaction? You say, yeah, maybe a year, maybe a week, maybe a day, maybe like until you have to go to work.
You have to go
yeah. Or sometimes it's longer, right? Sometimes people really find a fulfilling job. But at a certain point, right, and then we want something different, something more, something better. Job becomes a problem, right? The job that we so wanted then becomes a problem. You get the relationship. You get bored, you get restless, you need to change things up. And, in relationships, always pose their challenges. So it's not, it's not the end all be all. The house, you buy the house, and then you have to pay the mortgage. And the roof leaks, and then you have to have a lawn, So again and again and again, we seek pleasure and make it we're fortunate, we find it. And then it doesn't last. It wears off. And then we want something else or something more. Then we seek again pleasure. It wears off. We want something else. would bring up the last. Partly because the satisfaction won't last, and partly because the thing itself doesn't last. So none of those things are truly satisfying. Or, you know, this is according to the Buddha, and if you don't have to agree with me, right? I encourage you to think about it. And if we put all of our energy into the external and we neglect our inner development, then when problems come, we can become overwhelmed, anxious. So we can't neglect our inner. Because, I mean, the external, right, when things are going well in our lives, we can think, oh, yeah, there's no problem. Everything's fine. Why do I need to do that Buddhist stuff? Why do I need to train my mind? You know, unfortunately, life is, you know, samsara, cyclic existence, unenlightening existence. Problems arise. Things play a small part, but mainly it's the mind that determines our happiness. Because we can have $1 billion and still be unhappy. I mean, we may know of some people, right, who have a lot of money. Sometimes they're the most unhappy people. There's, with having a lot of money, there can be accompanied by having a lot of fear. Fear of losing it. Fear of people taking advantage of you, right? And maybe people don't love you for you, but for your money. Oftentimes, oftentimes an underlying fear or anxiety, fear of losing it. And conversely, we can have a very simple life, not having much at all. You see that oftentimes with Tibetans, right? These beautiful, loving, happy people who have, you know, who don't have much money, who have to leave their country, and there's just this joy. And so why is that? Most of us are up and down. Sometimes happy, sometimes happy. Up and down. Maybe up and down from day to day or from hour. minute to minute. Okay. So what is it that goes up and down? This is better externally. Is it the body that's going up and down? Is it
our emotions?
It's our emotions, right? It's our minds. This is going up and down. Lamayeshi says, one day the world looks so beautiful. The next day, it looks terrible. He says, how can that be? The external world didn't change so radically. It's our mind that causes these appearances. Similarly, one person thinks that the world is so beautiful and people are wonderful and kind, while another thinks that everything and everyone are horrible. Who is right? How do you explain that scientifically? It's just their individual mind's projection of the sense world. Sometimes we encounter a situation, a difficult situation, a problem, where you can't do anything about the problem, right? And so we can sit there and be very, very frustrated and rail against that situation. Or we can try to transform our perspective. I mean, I know that for me, I noticed that sometimes I don't transform my attitude, my mind, until I absolutely have to, right? When the situation, right, the situation's just starkly right there, it's front of my face, and I can't change it. And then I, you know, and then I see how miserable I am, and then I think, okay, well, I can be miserable, or I can change my mind. And changing the mind is not endeavor. But then oftentimes those difficult situations are the greatest learnings, right? The greatest opportunity. You guys know that. So we're encouraged to look at our minds, right? Examine our attitudes, our thoughts, and see, right? What causes our happiness and what causes our suffering. Right, and to examine our attitudes, right, and thoughts and emotions, what causes them. You know, to examine that honestly and with a lot of kindness. A lot of kindness toward ourselves. Our experience of the world is transformed. Whereas if we seek to change only the external environment and the people in it, we continually meet with frustration and disappointment because we cannot control the external world. It is only by developing the great potential of our mind/hearts that we will be able to find a way out of our suffering and to truly benefit others as well. It is only by developing the great potential of our mind/heart that we will be able to find a way out of our suffering and to truly benefit others as well. So I truly believe this when I really examine it. Habitual attitudes, habitual hopes. Put so much energy into trying to find happiness in that. And in the end, we get disappointed, right? Because if we get it, it doesn't give us that deep satisfaction that we were hoping. So, the main obstacles to happiness, according to Buddhism, are the afflicted states of mind, the disturbing emotions, the distorted attitudes, and that we'll talk about, the hostility we have in our mind, our perpetual dissatisfaction, endless obsessive desire that we have. Possessiveness, right? All those states of mind cause mental unhappiness, cause distress. So the mental unhappiness is caused by our thoughts. All of our mental unhappiness is caused by our mental conditions. So that's something to explore. So we're trying to reduce and ultimately eliminate those afflicted states of mind that bring about agitation in the mind, disturbance in the mind. And how do we reduce and eliminate those? Developing counter forces, which are also states of mind. Compassion, wisdom, generosity, patience. So developing more and more of the positive, constructive, beneficial states of mind, and reducing and unfortunately, you can't do that just through force of will, right? Or just by deciding, right? It takes more nuance. Did you have a question?
No.
Did you have one? I was reading something. Dalai Lama has a book called Approaching the Buddha's Path. And he was talking about how don't have to, right? You don't have to have a religion. You don't have to be a religious person. But he was talking about how there are some basic spiritual qualities we need to develop, basic human qualities that we need to develop, such as compassion, gentleness, kindness, humility. And he says, when these qualities are well established in our hearts, we will have more peace of mind and will contribute to the happiness of others. And then he said that kind of something that kind of stunned me with its simplicity, but you know, also with its clarity. He says, and we cannot be happy without these basic qualities. What were the qualities again? Right, compassion, gentleness. Yeah, actually, he says, compassion, gentleness, affection, humility.
Ask that question directly to Dalai Lama in 2 weeks. Dalai Lama will be dialing into Sacramento in 2 weeks.
Oh.
He's coming to Sacramento?
Dialing in.
Oh, dialing in.
He'll be in Dharamsala, mm-hmm. but we are having a teleconference with people in Sacramento. So people in Sacramento can actually talk to him. Mm-hmm. Well,
where?
Trinity. It's the big house is doing it.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Yeah. And if you think about it, right, a lack of compassion. If our heart is blocked, right, if we don't care about others, very judgmental of others, or have hostility toward others, right, is it possible to have happiness? Misunderstanding, believing that things exist in some solid, concrete way, and especially the me, the self, believing that there's a me that's solid and separate, fundamentally separate from others, and then we become preoccupied with that me. And my needs and what I want and my others, right? We like others that reinforce that me, our self-concept, that make me feel good, and then we feel threatened by and have maybe even hostility toward others that threaten that me. And then based on that fundamental conception, right where that right, we don't exist fundamentally separate and solid from others. That's a big topic, right? We're all interdependent, right? This body comes from sperm and egg of two other people, right? And food that other people grow, and water from the outside, etc., right? We cannot actually come into existence without other. And we cannot survive without other. We cannot be happy without other. And yet, we know this, and yet we still think of ourselves as being separate, so fundamentally separate. And based on that separation, we have the disturbing emotions arise, right? We have attachment to those things that will bring me happiness and pleasure. And we have aversion and hostility to those that threaten me or bring me pain. And all of the other disturbing emotions, jealousy, self-importance, all of those things. All of those disturbing emotions come about based on this fundamental misunderstanding. And then based on those disturbing emotions, then we create negative karma, negative actions, right? We criticize others, selfish actions, speak harshly toward others, etc. And so the negative karma comes about, according to Buddhism, as unfortunate circumstances in lives. So if I speak harshly to others, sooner or later it comes back around and others will speak harshly. So according to Buddhism, right, all of our difficulties, all of our problems, all of our suffering comes from these things, from negative karma, which results from disturbing emotions, which results from this fundamental misunderstanding of how things exist. So good news is that we can eliminate all of our suffering, all of the pain, forever. That's possible. And attain a state of lasting peace and happiness, attain liberation and enlightenment. By eliminating those disturbing emotions, by stopping the negative karma, by stopping the disturbing emotions, uprooting the disturbing emotions, by so it's possible, right? And there's a path to it. It's very possible. It's not some mystery. It's actually happiness comes about by developing, right, a deeper and deeper and more pervasive understanding of how things actually exist, the interdependent nature. And then reducing the disturbing emotions, increasing the positive states of mind, like compassion and kindness. And it becomes easier and easier to develop those positive states of mind through habit. And the less we hold on so strongly to the me, that solid, confident me, and the less we hold on so strongly to my happiness first and foremost. The more we open our hearts to others, the more we care about others, the more we genuinely and sincerely from the heart care about others. That wellspring of joy getting, right, going beyond that narrow self, forgetting, you know, momentarily at least, about me. Repressing our needs and being nice on the outside and, you know, pretending that we care about other people's problems, right? I mean, that just makes us really antsy, right? We don't, right? I mean, it's genuinely, right, organically, slowly, right, developing deeper qualities in our hearts. And we all have the seed in us, right? We all have that potential. And what's preventing us from being able to actualize our fullest potential of our hearts are the disturbing emotions and that preoccupation. But we can do it. So I wanted to mention something about, right, these positive and negative emotions. What it means in Buddhism versus what it means in Western psychology, according to his book. Right, so he says that in Western psychology, right, a positive emotion is something that makes the person feel happy at the time it manifests, and the negative emotion is one that feels bad and makes the person unhappy at the time it manifests. So that's Western psychology. But Buddhism is a little bit different in that what differentiates positive and negative emotions in Buddhism is not the immediate feeling of happiness. But it's the happiness or suffering that's the long-term result of that emotion. Because the long-term effect is considered much more important than immediate, that short-term effect in Buddhism. If in the long-term an emotion brings about peace, a positive emotion. Whereas whereas if the emotion brings up an unpleasant result in the long term, it's a negative emotion. Right, so sometimes, right, a positive emotion can, right, in Buddhism, not feel that great in the moment, but it brings about a deeper sense of happiness and well-being in the long term. So what's an example of that? Something that's uncomfortable,
like being generous with something that you don't want to give away.
Right, yeah, being generous. I mean, oftentimes, right, our generosity is mixed, right? Like, giving away, but there's some pain involved, too. And it's good, right? It's good to give it, even if it's a little bit painful, because you're letting go of this tight grasping, right? Opening. Okay. I was thinking, whose kids are going off to college soon, and it's such this painful experience for the parents, and yet, you know, but it's a joyful experience too, right? And right, it's a sign that, right, the child is ready to go, right, growing up and all of that. But it's painful too, right? You can't, like, it, you can hang on to them and not lose them right now, but probably lose them. right, no.
Eventually they get away.
Yeah. And so, and then also sometimes an emotion can feel really good in the moment and yet be a negative emotion. Right? So we're all familiar with that. Grasping onto. Right? Like rejoicing when somebody you dislike has a problem. Right? It's hard not to. But ultimately, right, that's not going to bring about a positive result for yourself. It's not bringing about a deep sense of well-being and having such a grasp of things. Okay. Any questions on anything so far? Sounds like it's all a review.
Moving does not mean the air is cold coming out of
yeah.
it.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
But I do feel cooler.
I did feel cooler.
We can try it and see.
Okay.
We can put it on.
Yeah. And just speak up right if it's too hot, you know, people can.
Yeah,
but
I think turn
it
off.
Yeah, it seems to be off
for
a bit.
Yeah.
It's so much. It's so nice not having the fan.
Yeah, it's more peaceful, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. So we'll try it without it. It feels like it's cooler
than
her. I'm sorry, and if I'm not speaking loud enough, please let me know. Because, yeah, well, I don't have the loudest voice either, so I don't. It sounds really loud in my ears. But other people don't seem to have the same experience of my voice.
It's easy to hear without the fan.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's okay now.
Oh, yeah,
yes.
Decidedly.
All right. Okay.
Decidedly
better. Okay. All right. So, yeah. Okay. So happiness. No getting around changing, transforming the mind. So what is the mind? What is the mind of Buddhism? As I mentioned already, it's not just the intellect, right? In English, normally we think of it as the intellect, but it's, right, it's our feelings and emotions as well, right? So we're talking in Buddhism, right? So we're talking about transforming our feelings, emotions, transforming our attitudes, transforming perceptions. So, right, and when I may use the term mind, consciousness, awareness, right, those are all interchangeable terms in this tradition of Buddhism. So the definition of mind, according to Buddhism, is that which is clear and knowing, sometimes translated as clarity and awareness. So there's this clear / clarity aspect of it, and then there's this kind of knowing, cognition, awareness aspect of it. So clear, I mean, I've heard different interpretations of clear. The most common interpretation is that it's the mind is considered something that's not material. The mind is not
that it's like a mirror that allows things to appear in it. Like a mirror reflects whatever comes in front of it. The mind doesn't just reflect what's really there, and the mind distorts things and interprets and all of that. But the mind, there's a space in which things can arise. So the mind is not the brain, according to Buddhism. The mind is an experience, right? An experience of something, right? It's at least partly independent upon the brain, right? There's a correlation between the brain and our mental states, right? But the mind is not the brain, right? And I think mind according to science, it's not really known what the mind is in Western science. It's generally considered to be something that's the same as the brain or something that arises from the brain. But in Buddhism, it's very specific that it isn't the brain, but it's an experience, right? Feelings, right? An experience of something. Feelings that arise independent on a situation. Our perceptions, our experience of things. Right, and if the mind was the same as the brain, let's just play with that a little bit, then if there's a brain in a jar, there would be a mind. And is there a mind when there's a brain in the jar? An experience of pleasure or pain or happiness, suffering, experience of anger or why did you put me in the jar?
Not as far as we know.
Just a hunk of conduit, right?
Yeah. It doesn't, yeah, we don't know, right? A dead body, right? There's still a brain, but is there still a mind? Sorry, it's just some things to think about. So the mind is not the brain. It's something not material, according to Buddhism. And if you do like Mahamudra meditation or meditation on this nature of mind, right, you're meditating on that space-like nature of mind, and so you can experience that. All right, the other aspect of mind is the knowing or the cognition, right? So mind is not material. It's like space, but it's not exactly like space because there's an awareness, right? There's an awareness of an object. There's awareness of, like, there are feelings, et cetera. Yeah, there's cognition. There's thinking. We all know about thinking. So I'm going to read something that Alex Berzin wrote, a Buddhist scholar. He says, in the Buddhist discussion of the mind, then we're not talking about some sort of thing or organ that is in our head, like the brain. Rather, we're talking about some sort of occurrence that is happening on the basis of the brain and the nervous system. What is happening when we see, hear, or think something? Although we may be able to describe the occurrence biochemically or electrochemically, we can also describe it subjectively. Subjectively, right? And that's the subjective experience is what we're talking about as being the mind in Buddhism. All right. always refers to an experience and the contents of the experience. An experience of pleasure when I eat ice cream. Right, and the experience of the ice cream itself. Not that I like ice cream. Okay. And then the other thing is that the essence of the mind is fundamentally pure. Right? That our afflicted mental states, our irritation, our impatience, our obsessive attachments, our jealousy, none of those are intrinsic to the mind. They're like passing clouds in the mind, whereas the mind is like the clear blue sky, and then those afflicted mental states are clouds that cover that pristine, pure, essential nature.
What about compassion and humility and kindness and gentleness? Are those also passing clouds?
Those are also passing clouds, yeah. But they become more and more deeply ingrained, right, as we train. So those become spontaneous, right? Because, you know, when we first start training the mind, maybe we don't have a whole lot of compassion or humility. Right? And so those states just come sporadically through effort, right? And then the more we train in those, the more they become ingrained into our personality, into our character, until they're just a part of us. Yeah, so another thing that I want to say about those afflicted mental states, and we'll talk about this more in the coming weeks, but the afflicted mental states are based on this fundamental misunderstanding of how things exist. Right? There's some distortion or exaggeration in all of the afflicted mental states. And so that's why they can be removed, because they're based on inaccurate view of how things exist, right? And so when we realize how things actually exist, those can be removed. And they can be removed completely and forever and uprooted, because they're based on a misunderstanding, right? So when you see it's a misunderstanding, then you can uproot those. Whereas compassion and humility and love and kindness are not based on that misunderstanding. They're based on an actual understanding of how things actually exist. And so they can be developed fully, you know, to an infinite degree, and won't be, right? And will become stronger and stronger as we understand reality more and more accurately, right? So it's kind of, you know, it's very interesting to me, right? It's like the spiritual path is very logical. It's, it's really largely about seeing things more and more correctly. Yeah. And then the positive states gradually, naturally get stronger, and the negative states naturally, slowly.
So does the Buddha's mind not have clouds, or are the clouds just the compassion, that stuff?
Yeah. So,
clouds might not be the right analogy,
yeah,
but
yeah,
like is the Buddha in that constant place of like the clear sky without any thoughts or emotions, or because I know it's like a state of bliss, but yeah, or is it just like in that pure state of clear and knowing all the time?
So maybe before I answer that question, I'm going to change my analogy. instead of using clouds, I'll say, you know, the mind is, right, pure and clear and clean, like the clean, clear blue sky. Mm-hmm. And the afflicted states of mind are like pollution.
Mm-hmm.
We'll use that one. That one works a little bit better. Right, pollution which can be cleansed.
Mm-hmm.
And so, right, so those afflicted states of mind are like pollution, but compassion and sort of those positive qualities are not pollution.
Right.
Yeah. So the Buddha's mind, okay, so in my understanding, right, my limited understanding, so the Buddha's mind is, right, it's in that clear, spacious, all the time, imbued by the compassion, the humility, etc., that they developed along the path, right, while they were bodhisattvas, etc. When a Buddha becomes completely enlightened, it's said that a Buddha no longer has thought, no longer has a conceptual mind, but perceives everything directly. So, you know, so those, you know, that doesn't mean the Buddha doesn't, like, know right things, right? The Buddha has, right, knows others' minds, it's the Buddha. But the Buddha doesn't know things in the same way that we know things, right?
It's not like a linear, like, so what am I going to do today?
Right.
You thought,
right. Yeah. I mean, from what I, my understanding. Yeah, it's, you know, I remember I once had a lama named Kriya Sanchen Rinpoche, who was just this amazing, beautiful, sweet lama who spent 12 years in solitary retreat in Dharamsala, right? And, you know, and he would walk into the room and seemed like he wasn't even, I don't know, funny, but other people say this too, right? But it felt like he wasn't even touching the ground, right? He was just kind of just floating. And anyway, and his, like, and I would, you know, and I had a few audiences with him, and I would ask him questions. And it was this very interesting experience in that, like, oftentimes, like, I would think I would know, right, what I'm trying to ask. And then I'd be in his presence, like, you know, like, a little confused, like, I'm not sure how to ask this question, right? And I remember one time asking him a question and it not coming out very clear. Like, I wasn't that clear what my question was. And so, first of all, when he answered the question, he always would answer the question without even appearing to think, right? He would just answer spontaneously. Like, you would right, ask the question, and he wouldn't sit there, like, you know, usually when you're, like, if somebody asks me a question, right, you can kind of tell all that they're thinking, right? He would just spontaneously and immediately answer the question that I meant to ask. Right. He wouldn't, like, he knew what I was actually trying to ask,
yeah.
And he would just, like, he would spontaneously know, right, without doing this, like, cogitating. I mean, that's the way it appeared, right, and other people would say that to me as well. It was just kind of jaw-dropping, right, just, because he just had this incredible depth of wisdom about him. Clarity of mind, and No, and he would remember everything. Like, he remembered everything. Like, I remember once I met with him, maybe, I don't know, 5 or 6 years after the previous meeting with him. And I would just say, oh, yeah, the last time I saw you, you know, and he would just cut me off and say, yeah, and I gave you this advice, and you attended that empowerment, right, with 200 other people on that day, and right, it was just this mind-blowing kind of like, wow, right, and a friend of mine had that same experience with him and hadn't seen him, like, for 20 years, and he remembered, oh, yeah, the last time I saw you, you gave me this present, and you were on your way to Thailand to go meditate for a year, and yeah, it was just this. I think he had some realizations. Yes.
I have a question for you.
Oh, wait, before, I'm sorry. Did I answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, leave it back.
Yeah. Am I trying to force this analogy too much? With afflicted states, afflicted emotions, is it because they're, well, on the line, is it because they're dependent on outside things, outside states? Because we're seeing what's wrong, as opposed to compassion, loving kindness, etc. Is there a direct correlation that is an inside job versus reaching for or trying to get satisfaction and joy out of something outside ourselves? Am I trying too hard here to make a fit?
I think that I'm going to address that later in this class.
Okay.
And if I don't, please ask that question again. Yeah. I think I want to answer it in the context of what I'm talking about then. If I understand your question correctly. But if I don't, mm-hmm. poke me.
Pardon me.
All right. Halfway through, shall we take a break? Or, Pam, what
did
you have?
Oh,
I was just, sorry.
That's okay. I'll answer that anyway. You're smiling. I was just thinking it feels kind of like that omniscient Buddha way of being, that way that is so clear and knowing. Perhaps in my little child brain comes to be as a result of the developing that sort of detached compassion, right, that allows you to see things almost like a movie that you're not really a part of, mm-hmm. not take it personal, so your mind's not all caught up in all that swirl, so it can be clear enough to really see
yeah.
what's going on, and that gives you that ability to remember all those things, because your brain's not being held up, you know, whatever brain is in that moment, right, I'm using terms that are the only words I know, right, so it just, you know, it's like, wow, you know, does that come from clear and knowing, because like, I certainly don't feel clear and knowing.
but your mind is clear and knowing, sure, but yeah.
You know, but it's so trapped in, what are they thinking, what am I thinking, what am I going to do, oh, my knee hurts, so this is going on, you know, oh, they did that because of this, or oh, that driver, why did they cut me off, you know, it's so caught up in all that it doesn't have time to go, oh, look, that poor person needs to get somewhere really fast, so I'm going to slow down and let them get there, right? I mean, it just gets so caught up in that other stuff.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. I mean, all of that, you know, that constant conceptualizing, that like, dislike, what, you know, what are they going to think about me, and how, you know, referencing us, ourselves, right, with what, everything that happens, like, oh, that person that cut me off, well, they cut me off, right? All right, or that rude person was right, why did they do that to me? And, you know, that wasn't right, whereas it's just, you know.
So you chase them down.
It doesn't happen anyway.
Even though they wouldn't even know we do, but you chase them down anyway.
It's so exhausting, right? It's like, it pollutes our minds, or it covers up the clarity of our minds and the natural peacefulness of our minds. And yeah, and you know, as we start being able to let go of those things, right, and not have so much self-reference, right, it frees up so much space in the mind and so much energy. I mean, I've heard, right? It's like your memory really gets sharper, right? Your mind gets sharper, right? And you have a lot more energy to do things, right? And energy, right, natural compassion arises more, right? Because you're not concerned about what that person did to me, and right? It's just, that you see that person is suffering, right? Oftentimes we don't see that a person is suffering. We see that person makes me uncomfortable, right? And we're trying to deal with that as opposed to that homeless person is just really suffering and needs something, right? And or really, most sentient beings are suffering. Well, all sentient beings are suffering, right? On some level. But, So maybe the answer is yes. That's one of the super nice things about the path, right? You don't have to wait until you're enlightened to get the benefits, right? The more we practice, the more we're able to let go of those constant, right?
The more convincing it is. Like driving down the freeway now, if someone cuts me off, I don't think, oh, you, whatever. I think, wow, clearly you need to get somewhere. I hope you get there safe. It makes my life more happy.
Yeah.
I'm not all angry, and I feel overwhelming compassion, which always brings joy right after it. So it really shifted the experience of driving on the freeway when I trained myself to see it that way.
Yeah.
It doesn't always work, right? If I'm tired and hungry, sometimes I'm not so good at that. But
sure.
But I do my best.
But it's right. It's wonderful, right? Because you see, I did that and it really worked, and I can do that and I can do more of that. And
it was just a shift of thought.
Yeah. So we're going to have a half day also later on May 13th or 12th.
Yeah,
and so my idea is to meditate on the space-like nature of mind, right? And then to see more and more of those thoughts as being like space-like nature of mind, and not like, and see them and not get sucked into them. Slowly, right, to have more space of the mind all throughout the day, right, as much as possible, right? And the more space we have in our minds, then when the negative thoughts arise, they don't take up the entire mind, right? If the mind is this big, then the negative thought arises and it takes over the whole entire mind, right? But the more we can be in a spacious mind, then we can see it like a water bubble and dissolve it. I mean, the deeply ingrained thoughts, not so much, right? But slowly, slowly, yeah, we can do that with the easier thoughts, and then gradually.
I know you're going to take a break, but seems like karma also plays a role in what kind of thoughts get generated.
Yes.
Right? When something happens.
Absolutely.
Am I having this, like Pamela was saying, am I having a compassionate response, or am I really pissed off at them? And I'm guessing I don't really choose them. Okay, I'm going to have a compassionate thought right now. It's not my will. Those thoughts are coming, they're generated, so I'm guessing karma is playing what clouds get generated.
Mm.
So karma is the cloud generation machine.
Well, I mean,
you can shift the clouds.
Yeah, I mean, the instinctive response is a result of the mental habits we've created, which are karma, right? And we can choose what to do at that point, right? We can choose to try to counteract that negative thought, and we can try to choose to think about that other person just being in a hurry or being stressed, and you know, can choose to try to develop a compassionate response. We can't always succeed, right? But we, there's definitely a choice there, right? So there's the situation is a result of karma, and our instinctive response, I think, is a result of karma. And it's not like it's predetermined and there's nothing you can do about it, right? And then we can do something on top of that. Yeah. All right. Let's take a break. 10 minutes?
Is talk with people and help us as individuals figure out how to approach social justice in a way that is meaningful and sustainable for us. Because sometimes it's so overwhelming. Like, there's so much suffering. There's so many causes to join. And so he really, that's what his vision is for this class, I believe. It could change when he's actually here in the room. But he is a reverend at Trinity Episcopal Church. So he's an Episcopalian reverend, and he's amazing. And he's taught here before, so he's very familiar with the Buddhist tradition, and he's just a phenomenal speaker, very inspiring. And so this is a great one to bring your friends and family to. And so that's going to be this Friday, and he's actually going to be leaving Sacramento sometime soon. So the opportunity to see him speak is getting smaller by the day.
Where's he going?
I'm not sure, but
like,
I think
he's leaving for good.
Yeah, I think he got a position somewhere else. That's kind of what I heard through the grapevine. But Brandy was in working too.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Emily is going to be teaching a class Sundays from 10 to 11:30. And it's going to be more of like questions and meditation, or is it going to be more of a formal teaching?
I'll just choose a topic, you know, like patients or dealing with criticism or something like that, you know, just a drop-in topic, you know, just a practical topic. And I'll say a little bit about it, and then we'll have questions and discussion and meditation. The idea is to kind of continue what Venerable Tenzin was doing.
Yeah, so kind of blend, like, how do we take the real the teaching?
Very practical.
Kind of
real life kind of thing.
Yeah.
That's the idea. Tenzin and I have very different personalities, but we'll just try something.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's going to be on the next two Sundays from 10 to 11:30. And then we're going to try, we haven't done this before, but we're going to try and do like a little potluck afterwards. So if you have the capacity to bring something to share afterwards, you can hang out, have some tea. You know, people are welcome to stay. And just the potluck items should be vegetarian. And it's going to be really casual, so we wanted to let people know that. And then on Monday, David Drabble is going to continue teaching meditation through the end of May. And he is going to be coordinating with Emily to do meditations that will help us deepen our understanding of the classes that she's teaching. And he is studying with Emily. He's been meditating for a really, really long time, probably over 20 years. And he's really knowledgeable about the subject, and Fernando's been going to that class. Mm-hmm. Is it okay if people ask you questions about this class if they are curious about how it's been going and stuff like that? And that's from 6:30 to 8 Monday night. And that is all my announcements. Except finally, we're a donation-based center. We have a bowl in the front. And so give what you're able. It helps us pay our rent, support our teachers, keep the lights on, all of that good stuff. And I have flyers right here, and there's some at the door if you want to grab any. That'd be great.
So our mind is fundamentally pure, and so it's not like the religions that say that, you know, fundamentally we're sinners, right? It's different in Buddhism that our essence is fundamentally pure, and so we can remove the pollution of our minds, right? The afflicted states are like pollution, or like dust on the mirror that can be cleaned. Yeah.
about the six consciousnesses in Buddhism. Does everybody already know this stuff? To review. So, basically, it's different according to different philosophical schools of Buddhism, but the main presentation according to the school is that there are six consciousnesses, right? Five sense consciousnesses and a mental consciousness, right? Sense consciousnesses are the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, right? That perceive, right? The eye consciousness perceives colors and shapes. The ear consciousness perceives sounds. The nose consciousness perceives odors, etc., right? So the sense consciousnesses perceive sense data, right? Sights, sounds, colors, shapes, sounds, odors, etc. Tastes. And then the sixth consciousness is the mental consciousness, which there's actually two subsets of mental consciousness, a conceptual mental consciousness. There's also a non-conceptual mental consciousness that I'm not going to actually talk about because that doesn't actually really come into effect until further along the path. I want to talk about conceptual consciousness. So the conceptual consciousness, right? So the sense consciousness perceives just data. And the conceptual consciousness interprets that data, labels that, judges, interprets, etc. So the So starting with a simple example, right? So the eye consciousness, the sense consciousness, the eye consciousness would perceive just red, gold, etc., right, in a particular shape. And then conceptual consciousness would label it table, would label it beautiful or ugly or neutral. We don't have a lot of stories about tables, right? So that was a pretty simple one, right? Or a person, right? You see, right? The sense consciousness just perceives colors and shapes, maybe sounds if that person is talking, odors, etc., right? And then it's our conceptual consciousness that decides, right? Well, that labels nice person, not nice person, attractive, unattractive. I want to get to know that person. I don't want to have anything to do with that person, right? Annoying, right? Or wonderful, right? That all comes from the conceptual consciousness. So good and bad come from the conceptual consciousness. Beautiful, ugly comes from the conceptual consciousness. Desirable, undesirable comes from the conceptual consciousness. Attractive, unattractive comes from the conceptual consciousness. Horrible, terrible comes from the conceptual consciousness. Right? Our interpretation of the data that we perceive. So, the beautiful, ugly, attractive, unattractive, annoying comes from our minds, our interpretation, and doesn't actually come from the thing itself. So we perceive data, then we label it, interpret it, judge it. Sense consciousness versus conceptual consciousness, right? So
it's the conceptual consciousness that causes all of our mental suffering. It's the mental afflictions, all of the disturbing emotions are based on the conceptual consciousness, based on our interpretation of that data. Some of you are nodding, so it sounds like this is all our view.
This is great. I've sort of kind of heard it from other teachers, but it's really helpful to hear it, so.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's super helpful.
Yeah.
Super helpful.
Don't go any faster. Don't
stay right there.
Don't change. Stop extending this reality on me. As we transparent about it.
Yeah. And I right, so yeah, and so yeah, when I first got that light bulb that all of my, right, that the agitated states of mind were caused by the way I interpret things. All my agitated states of mind are conceptual, are thoughts, based on thoughts. States of mind arise from our thoughts, our attitudes, our interpretations, which means that we can change them. Those agitated states of mind, unhappy states of mind, right, are not just, well, that's just who I am, right, and there's nothing I can do about it, right, they're changing, they're based on thoughts. Data directly, right? We're perceiving sounds, odors, etc. directly. And then the conceptual consciousness, right, takes that data and then interprets it, labels it, and overlays that data with a mental image. So we're actually seeing things through that mental image, and that, and we're mistaking our mental image for what is actually there. So the person says some words, right? We hear some sounds. We interpret those sounds as annoying, and then we overlay, right, annoying, right, over that person, and we think that annoying person comes from them, okay? Whereas annoying person came from our mind. So we're perceiving things through our mental image, through our filters, through our preferences, through our expectations, through, yeah, our biases, through our previous experiences, through our previous education. So we're constantly seeing things.
our mental happiness sometimes, depending on what our interpretation is, depending on what our label is. And oftentimes we're seeing things through our habitual patterns, right? Oftentimes, and through insecurities, etc., right? Seeing other people, situations, as well as ourselves. So let's go through some examples. Yeah. We see, if we live with somebody and we see dirty dishes left in the sink, what is our perception? What is the data that we're perceiving?
I didn't do those.
what's the data? What are we perceiving?
Cylinders, shaped things in the basin or,
square.
Like with debris on them. I don't have debris.
That you did not put there.
That's not in perception.
Oh, that's true. That's the label of judgment, isn't it?
So some cylinders and
flat things,
some round things,
pokey things.
In a rectangular, so that's what we're perceiving. So what is the conceptual mind then doing on top of that?
That's where we go to who put them there and why are they there. I didn't do those, and somebody should be doing those dishes, but not me. And
I don't like being dirty. And
I would never leave dishes like that.
But even simpler than that, because before that, even we have to label it cup, and then label it dirty cup, and then label it not my dirty cup, and then right.
Yeah.
Annoying dirty cup.
Yeah, but it all happens so fast it feels like it's all happening at once, but it's not actually happening at once.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Good catch, Mark.
On a very basic level, just dirty cup,
mm-hmm.
dirty dishes. Mm-hmm. Not supposed to be dirty dishes.
Yeah.
Might be one of the labels, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that maybe is what causes the annoyance, right? So what is the cause of the annoyance?
My need to have no dirty dishes.
Mm-hmm.
That's the cause of the annoyance. It's ruined out the dirty dishes themselves. It's just I have this need to not have them there.
Yeah. So what is an alternative way of looking at that might not bring about a disturbing emotion?
Somebody must have really been in a hurry. Perhaps I'll do them for them and then they won't be there anymore.
That's nice. What else?
That dirty dishes aren't inherently annoying or not annoying or good or bad. And it's not coming from the dirty dishes. Or the person that put them there.
But it is.
checking with emotion, and sometimes emotion has a story to it, and so to isolate the story, you know, could be that I'm telling myself that this person doesn't care about me, and to maybe just even give that some space and some room and some awareness around it, so I'm not caught in that story and that experience. Right, I can acknowledge it's like we talked about it, this is already generated. Now how do I meet this with waking up to what's actually happening? Because then I'm caught in the story, and then if I can have awareness, then I have choice. Maybe something else can come from that.
Yeah.
I can make a whole narrative, and really they just almost missed their bus.
Has anyone ever encountered a situation where you think it was somebody else who did it, and then later on you realize,
Oh, yeah.
Well,
it was
definitely
the fastest way to not be mad anymore.
Okay. Yeah, well, you know, okay. That's okay. I was tired.
Yeah. They made me.
Give myself a break, right? That's so. Wait
until
you give the other person a break. Yeah.
That's funny.
All right. Okay.
Oh, my stars.
Yeah. Right. So we can use it to develop more wisdom, that it doesn't come from its own side, that it's right, the mind, or generosity, understanding, right, of the other person.
By so many things, from what I ate that morning to how much sleep I got to just my general demeanor in that moment.
Yeah. And our expectations, attachments, as you were saying. All right. How about
through the air.
Yeah. Yeah, just some vibrations, some sounds.
You also see the lips moving.
Right, some sounds, some movement of colors and shapes.
Any ferocity, you might feel wind in the rain.
Okay, and then some possibilities for how our conceptual mind can deal with that data, those sounds. Okay, what's the habitual?
Discriminating. What the cause is, where it's originating from.
Discriminating.
Yeah.
Yeah, trying to understand. Yeah. Whether it's valid, where that's coming from?
Really fast.
Yeah, there's like this time where you're trying to decide if you should be offended or not. Is Ben insulting me?
Yeah.
Do I care? Interesting when you deconstruct it in that way, isn't it?
I mean,
thinking about that pieces of the science puzzle versus the whole gene moving, it just makes it so much easier to go, oh, why do I even get angry about that? Why do I, you know, let it
shift me in a negative way at all.
No, I mean, it's very helpful for the mind. I mean, because normally it all happens right, all at once, immediately, you know, through our habitual patterns, right? And, right, maybe taking offense, or maybe, right, maybe being, feeling hurt, or, or getting angry. Onto it with my mind. Right? What, how am I interpreting it? And that we have a choice. Yeah.
It seems very much like the NVC stuff that Sunil and Jay have been inoculating us with now for so long, right? Sending us out in the world to be kinder, gentler people. That whole conceptual conscious phase and just seeing it as sounds coming from another potentially, you know, happy, sad, whatever, being. And
Yeah, and so that's the other thing, right? I mean, seeing it just as being, like, sounds, right? It's just sounds. And, it's, you know, one thing that NBC does so well is, right, and right, not necessarily just seeing it about how it affects me, what they're doing to me, right? But what's going on for that person? Right? Trying to step out of that me, right? Which is where, right, our unhappy states of mind, our afflictions, almost always, right, are always, if not, right, if not always, then almost always. Me, that person's doing it to me, that person shouldn't be doing it to me, I don't deserve that, right, and not seeing the other person's reality at all, oftentimes, right, and when we're caught in our difficult emotion, it's so difficult. Deconstructing it, and right, I mean, it is kind of the first step to seeing that we have many options of how we can deal with that situation, how we can see that situation, how we can interpret that situation. Yeah, all right.
It seems like deconstructing seems like such a useful tool, especially when something is so emotionally charged that it's hard to step out of that, but almost like how we, because I kind of do that when I get offended for myself of like, okay, well, which part did they offend, you know what I mean, like that piece, but it's like, where's the badness in that, you know what I mean, is it the lips moving, is that the bad part, or is it the, you know, the wetness coming out, is it, you know what I mean, so it's like where, like looking for that badness and then realizing there isn't any.
Great.
That seems like a really useful way to kind of like analyze the situation.
Right, yeah. I mean, that, it sounds like you're using emptiness for that, which is super helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah, and sometimes that doesn't work, right?
Right.
Sometimes, like,
a lot of times.
I don't care, you know. That was wrong.
Yeah.
Right? Doesn't, you know, that, yeah, whatever. Yeah. Yeah, that Buddhist stuff. But that was.
That was the exception.
That was just totally wrong, right? And then, and that's where we need a lot of different tools in our toolbox, right? Like, okay, well, tried that one, that didn't work. Tried, you know, another one. Yeah. But I find it very helpful, you know, I mean, I notice that oftentimes we've developed, like, a conclusion about another person's actions. Like, without, like, knowing anything, right? Oh, that person didn't call me back. Well, you figured it all out, right? That's because that person is just inconsiderate and, you know, doesn't care right about me.
They're mad at me.
Right? They're mad at me. Right? And yeah. And it's useful to just see, oh, this is just a story I'm creating in my mind. Oh, there I go again, right? And it's only a story, and it may have nothing to do with reality, right? It might be, right, that you called the wrong number. Right? And they didn't even get your message, right? Or something went wrong, right? Their phone is broken, or, you know, their voicemail is broken. Or, right, they have a crisis in their life, right? I mean, it can be so many different things, right? So it's so useful to just know, like, when we're creating a story, right? When it's just something coming from our mind, right? A label. And, you know, and try to just let go of that, like, burst that bubble and just see, okay, that's the, right? The data is lack of phone call. That's it. And that does not have to create any mental disturbance in the mind at all. Right? Oh, lack of phone call. Could be, I hope they're okay.
I had an experience where I came to know that the person that passed away.
Yeah.
And I knew that only like 2 months after.
Yeah. Right, and it's really hard to call back.
She was not there to call me. So, and she was much younger than me.
Yeah. Right, that'll switch your perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah, I heard a friend of mine had a similar experience. She had an argument about politics with this friend and told him how, you know, wrong and closed-minded and, you know, awful he was because of his opinions, right? And then she emailed him and he didn't email her back, and she's like, oh, that jerk, and all that, and then and then she was feeling terrible right after that. She was so terrible. And she decided not to argue about politics with people.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, how disturbed her mind was that whole time.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So maybe that can be an exercise. Deconstruct, right? See what the data is, and then just notice when we're spinning out on a story, and just give it space. Just like, well, maybe we can just think it could be something totally different. Right? Like, that's my habitual story, and it could be something totally different. And we can think about the other person.
And there's also positive stories.
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
Good people, nice people, I love these people.
Yeah.
And the same thing, right? The same conceptual consciousness.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And that's part of the mind training, right? Yeah. But also knowing, spend a lot of effort to improve the external condition of our lives, but in the end, it is always the mind that creates our experience of the world and translates this experience into either well-being or suffering. If we transform our way of perceiving things, we transform the quality of our lives. Thank you.
rise and grow, and in that born not decline, but increase.